good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday, the 18th of August. I hope you had a lovely weekend. It was a beautiful weather weekend. A lot going on as far, well, there wasn't much going on weather-wise. It was just sunny and beautiful. We talked about this Friday. We were playing music on Thursday and Friday from Billy Idol and Joan Jett. And I went to go see the show at SPAC last night. And I got into the car, oh, I don't know, maybe 5:30. And I looked on my dashboard, and it was 83 degrees. And by the time I reached the Saratoga Performing Arts Center, it was 64. And so then we went to a store and bought sweaters. But it was that kind
Shmata.
Of weekend. Yeah, that's right, Shmata. And then it reminded me what I have been told since I moved here 40 years ago, that this week is Fair Week in Washington County. It's the Washington County Fair.
And Dutchess County, too.
And Dutchess mm-hmm. County, too. And I was always told, well, that's when you get the sweatshirts out is Fair Week. And it's the flannel. It never goes that far, but it's the flannel and the shmata, and you put those on, and all's right with the world, and here we are. It's chilly, and the fair begins tonight in Washington County.
Do you normally go?
5 p.m. I met my wife at the fair.
No way.
I met my wife at the fair. How many years ago was it, Libby?
Oh, 30.
Yeah, something like that. And no. We were married in 94. We met in 92.
Okay, so that's...
No, you met Mike 5.
That's
33. You're 34, right? 32. What is it? 34?
I think her microphone is
on. Yeah, your mic isn't on, but that's all right. I'll turn you on. There you go.
92 to... 2005 is 33 because Lynn and I got together in 95.
Yeah. So we've been together for longer than you and Lynn.
Yes. Can you believe it?
No,
it's
I can't.
Astounding.
I can actually.
Right.
I was a stupid
Carney.
Right.
Oh no. Although that would have been a sight to see.
No, I was a radio guy. My wife worked at the fair. She was the carny. No, my wife worked at the fair. She was their PR person, and then she invited me to. I invited her to come on and talk about the fair for our little radio show, and then we've been together ever since.
The rest is history.
So we go every week, every night of the week, and just check out the fair and have a very good time. And
every night of the week, what is there to do?
Well, here's the key.
It's a I great, crank it out in 2 hours flat.
Okay, it's a great question. Here's what you do. You go in, you get a season pass, you get a week pass, okay? You park the car, you go in, you see a cow, you see a goat, you have chicken, you leave.
And the next day?
Second night, you see a duck, you see sheep, you go down, you go see the 4-H booth, you leave.
You get some ice cream, come on.
4-H.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Get a sugar fritter at the Methodist Church booth. Oh.
You mean the fried thing? Dough?
It's not fried dough. It's a fritter, and God, they're good. Oh, they're just
are they stuffed okay. with something?
Are they what?
Stuffed with anything?
Oh, stuff. I thought you said stuck. I was like, oh. No, they take it and they put they paint it with butter, and then it's powdered sugar.
Yeah, oh, which ugh.
Really?
Oh yeah, I don't like powdered sugar.
All right.
I mean, I like sugar, but I don't like that.
How about cinnamon and sugar?
Yeah, that's okay because it's still kind of the granular. Like granular, right?
Yeah.
It's the powder. Bleh.
Well, I just want to say if you get a chance, Dutchess County Fair is a beautiful fair. I've been to that fair. That's a fantastic fair. They do a wonderful job. If you get a chance to come up to the Washington County Fair, it's a large. I think the state's largest agricultural fair. So if you want to see a lot of farm animals and you want to see a lot of cows and just in a beautiful, beautiful environment, we welcome you to our humble fairgrounds.
It's, and the state fair starts Wednesday.
Yeah, and then the state fair, and this is very, if you've been to the state fair and then you go to the county fair, they're very different.
Yes.
One is like a farmer's market. The other one is like the Vegas Strip.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. So,
although the folks from Ag and Markets that work on it do a great job, and it's just a lot. One year we brought dogs up to be adopted, dogs and some cats, I think, and we were right behind
you brought
the
those
band
to the county
shell.
Fair?
No, or no, the state fair? They asked us to.
Oh, my God.
And we were right behind the band shell. Or,
oh, no.
And the dog, you know, it was like too loud, too noisy, too much. And we haven't been back.
This dog's not into Maroon 5.
Yeah, no. I mean, it wasn't even that. It wasn't that good. But
oh, okay.
Yeah, no. It was just really loud.
So, we'll stop talking about this stuff because it's not like there isn't big, huge, seismic things happening in the news. But again, hope you all had a lovely weekend. Let me introduce everybody to you, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College. Malia DeMond is here. Good morning, Malia. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. And I did take advantage of the nice weather this weekend. I went on a really long, tough hike with the Catskill 3500 Club, which is a great organization if people are looking to do nice group hikes in the Catskills.
Now, how long did the hike take you?
We started at 8 in the morning, and we came down the mountain at 6:30.
Oh, bless you.
Wow.
Yeah.
Bless you.
And it was a really tough. We did a crazy bushwhack, among other things. We did a bushwhack up Slide Mountain, which is the tallest mountain in the Catskills. I mean, it's not.
Do you know what a bushwhack is?
It means there's no trail.
Oh.
And
so
you're
that you
just
have
sort
to...
of, yeah, it's really okay. tough going. And Slide is.
I had no idea
for...
what a bushwhack was. I was hoping you could help me out.
Okay. Yeah. So, and I just want to give a shout out to our hike leader who's got the best hike name ever. I mean, his last name is Oak Hill.
And, oh, that's great.
And he he's like, you know those Ents from the Lord of the Rings?
Yeah.
He's like the human form of one of these Ents. And it's like a tall tree just walking ahead, striding up the mountain. And
there you go.
We were at the merry band following him.
Well, you feel confident when you have somebody like that leading the pack.
Yes.
Yeah, that's great.
And he hikes in winter in a kilt, which is awesome.
In a kilt?
Yes.
What a guy.
Yeah. See, that's what happens when you bushwhack too much.
You think?
Yeah. Don't even know what that means.
Yeah, well, Catherine... I'm sure we'll get some letters on that one.
Catherine Tan is here, Associate Professor of the Department of Sociology at Vassar College. Hello, Catherine. How are you?
Hi, good. My weekend was not as active. I still got bitten by a million mosquitoes, though. Yeah, we drove to Philly and back in the same day, and now I don't want to be in a car for a while.
Yeah, I mean that's not a day trip. Well, I mean you're farther down, but still that's a trip.
That was not supposed to be a day trip. I'm not doing that again.
Yeah, that's a lot. And political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post is here. Good morning, Libby.
Good morning. I'm good.
All right, let's get to the big news now. Friday. You'll remember we were talking about and speculating and wondering what was going to happen at the summit meeting that took place in Alaska, and it took place. It was far shorter than was expected. They were thinking it could go 5 or 6 hours. I think it went just under 3. And then there was going to be a press conference in which they were going to take questions. That never happened, and the details were kind of minimal. As to what went on, and when you look at the takeaways, the big takeaway is that the president of the United States, Donald Trump, walked in and said, "We want a ceasefire," and as he was walking out, said, "I don't need that." It was there was an awkward press appearance afterwards, and no formal deal. And then in a surprise announcement hours later, Trump dropped his demand for a ceasefire, saying Russia and Ukraine should start negotiating on a final peace deal instead. On Saturday, Trump told Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky that Putin wants Ukraine's Donbass region as a condition for ending the war. He said the United States is open to providing security guarantees for Ukraine in the wake of an agreement. Friday's summit ended without an agreement to secure peace in Ukraine, which was a long-standing goal for Donald Trump. Now, today, that brings us to Monday. So Volodymyr Zelensky is in Washington, and he has backup. He has leaders from Britain, France, and Germany who are with him, who will be among those joining Zelensky in Washington today after the president's Alaska summit with Putin. The United States is potentially prepared to be able to give Article 5 security guarantees, but not from NATO, directly from the United States and other countries, said U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff in a Fox News interview. Under Article 5 of the NATO Treaty, if a member country is attacked, each member of the alliance will consider this act of violence as an armed attack against all members and will take the actions it deemed necessary. Ukraine is not a member of NATO, but has been seeking support from allies since Russia launched its full-scale invasion in 2022. Witkoff said the security guarantee deal would be further discussed among the United States, Zelensky, and European leaders during the meeting this afternoon in Washington. European leaders will be joining that meeting to present a united front to help Zelensky navigate what Ukrainians anticipate could be a high-stakes and potentially emotional meeting on which Ukraine's future could hinge. Well, there's a lot more, but there we'll pause there because that's just that's enough. That's enough to get us started. Malia.
So I think it's important to think about the four different major players in these negotiations and what they what their goals are and what the progress is or is not towards those goals. And over all of this is, of course, you know, Donald Trump, one of the players, the United States. And for him, I think the deal making never ends. And that's one of the ways that he attempts to avoid criticism, and maybe that's an excuse that some of his followers use to avoid criticizing him as well. It's like, okay, well, he went in with the idea for a ceasefire, comes out and is not talking about ceasefire anymore, but that's just part of the deal-making process, right? So let's review. The four players, in my view, obviously Ukraine and Zelensky. Then there's the United States. Then there's Russia. Then there's the European allies. So before Friday, it was pretty clear that some of these players have more at stake than others, right? For Zelensky and Ukraine, this is an existential issue, and they weren't part of the discussion. I mean, they weren't party to it. But they're hoping that they wouldn't be further abandoned, right? No giving in to Russia, hoping that Trump wouldn't give in to Russia, and no major decisions about Ukraine without Ukraine. So that's what the Ukrainians were hoping would happen on Friday. Then Putin is going into this meeting on Friday, went into the meeting on Friday, characterizing this as existential for Russia as well. Is it really existential for Russian security the way it is for Ukraine? I would argue no, but that's the way he characterizes it, and that's the arguments he uses to his own people in Russia. And he wanted an agreement to, he's certainly not going to agree to a ceasefire. He wants the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine, which would give Russia direct access to the Black Sea and is also contiguous to a lot of Russian territory. And one of Putin's goals was lessening the support from Ukraine's allies to Ukraine. Trump's goals going into the meeting were, well, we heard it. He wants to, there's the performative part of it and then the substantial part of it. He wants to show himself as an international deal maker. I mean, he's chasing that Nobel Peace Prize and wants to show that he can apply his deal making skills to all manner of international problems that have proven too thorny for anyone else to resolve. And said there's only a 25% of failure of coming out of this meeting with a ceasefire. So he left himself that 25%, which is actually more than I would have expected him to say, you know. So for me, that shows about as much of a lack of confidence as I've ever seen out of Donald Trump. But nonetheless, he kept saying some kind of breakthrough was going to happen. And then Ukraine's allies are watching this meeting happen. I'm talking about mainly, you know, the Europeans, hoping that Donald Trump is not going to just, you know, sell Ukraine to Russia entirely and leave security guarantees and future support of Ukraine entirely on their shoulders. So that's how everyone went into it. After it, come out of the meeting, No, as you said, no press conference. Donald Trump characterizes the talks as frank and substantive. There's no deal. He said there was going to be a deal. There's no deal. And, you know, one of Putin's goals going into the meeting was to put more pressure on Ukraine. They come out of the meeting and Trump says it's on Zelensky to end this war. So what I see coming out of this meeting is President Trump, in a way, is advocating for some of the goals that Putin went into the meeting with. And Trump went into a lot of trouble. He, as far as I understand, was very involved in the details of the theater. Mm-hmm. A lot of international affairs is the public theater of it. And that really does matter. You know, rolling out the red carpet means something. The way you shake someone's hand, the kind of, you know, the military bands playing, all that stuff actually means something. And I think he expected it to further his goals more towards a ceasefire. It didn't, and it's a very different kind of press conference than we've seen Donald Trump participate in before. Usually, he gets up in front of the press, he rambles for a long time, he just enjoys that. And instead, this press conference started with him being silent for a while as Putin went on and on and on his own monologue. So it was. Different. So obviously the coming out of the meeting different from what it was characterized that it was going to be.
Right. And we're going to take a break and then we'll come back and we'll hear from Catherine and Libby. I just want to point out, though, that in our discussions over the last week on the panel, I mean, certainly we're not alone in this. But many prognosticators said, yeah, that could very well happen.
Right.
I mean, it was almost not expected, perhaps, but it was certainly figured in as a possibility.
Right, yeah.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Malia Dumont, Catherine Tan, and Libby Post. We welcome your letters on this and all the topics we will discuss on this Monday morning. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org will return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It's 9:34 on Monday, the 18th of August, and we thank you very much for being with us. We have been talking about what happened on Friday and the meeting between President Putin and President Trump and the lack of a ceasefire agreement as the President of the United States had hoped for. Now, there will be a meeting this afternoon with the President of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, as well as other European leaders with President Trump at the White House to try to further and figure out some semblance of a plan moving forward. We heard from Malia Dumont in our first segment. We go to Catherine Tan now.
All right. Well, that meeting with Putin went as well as any of us would have guessed. It's really, I mean, this is not surprising at all. Before going into the meeting with Putin, he had met Trump had met over the phone with other European leaders. They were trying to keep him in line, reiterating the goals. And Trump himself went into the meeting saying that there would be, I think he said, severe consequences if Russia did not agree to stop the war. I'm curious to see what those consequences will be. But it's predictable. The outcome was predictable in that we know that Trump has always wanted to maintain a good relationship with Putin. That is consistent, right? He has a history of admiring Putin's authoritarian flair. And, you know, as he demonstrated, being in Putin's favor is of a higher priority than his commitment to Europe and the Ukraine, which is really frightening. And I think it always comes back to what will Trump personally get out of this? Right. What, you know, the meeting and whether or not it's successful to him comes down to what does he have to personally gain from this interaction? He's not really, well, I don't think he's really thinking about Ukraine, Europe, or even the United States. He's thinking about what he could personally benefit from his relationship with Putin. He said after the summit, quote, "I always had a great relationship with President Putin, and we would have done great things together," end quote. And he said that Russia's, you know, he talked about Russia's incredible land and the rare earth, the oil, gas, and everything. So here, from what I can tell, he is hoping to end this war as quickly as possible, regardless of how things fall into place, because he potentially has business dealings that he can do with Putin and Russia. And I can't say that for sure, but from where I'm sitting, that's what it seems like, right? He does not seem to care that much about how things wrap up for the Ukraine. He does not seem to care whether or not Russia gets Ukrainian territory. For him, it comes down to what will he gain from fostering this relationship with Putin. And Putin is completely aware of how he can play Trump. Joe, we said, or you had mentioned earlier, back when he was Trump and Hillary were running, she had said he's a puppet to Putin. And that's exactly what we're observing right now. Putin, knowing how to kind of wrap Trump around his finger, during their conversation, he had brought up, you know, their shared hatred for President Biden, right? And so immediately, you know, that's, you know, Trump became putty in his hands. So I'm not surprised that he went in and came out, you know, without any deal. And even worse than that, you know, keeping open the possibility of Russia getting Donbass. So I'm not... I hope things go better with the meeting with Zelensky this today, right?
Right, this afternoon. Exactly. And, of course, we all remember the meeting that took place between Volodymyr Zelensky and Donald Trump in the White House in February, which was, I think by most accounts, a disaster. So there is pressure. Obviously, people will be watching those dynamics as well. Libby Post.
Well, Donald Trump is the 21st century Neville Chamberlain, if anybody remembers. You know, those of us who are of a certain age learned all of that in school about World War II and that Neville Chamberlain met...
So one life to live, right?
Yes, one life to live. That's absolutely. Neville Chamberlain was the British Prime Minister at the beginning of World War II. He met with Hitler. They did the non-aggression pact. They did the photo op, stood next to one another, blah, blah, blah. And then Hitler did whatever he wanted. And Chamberlain lost his position. Churchill came in, and they actually worked with all the Allies to win the war. But I am not surprised that nothing came out of this. I am totally not surprised. Who knows what Putin might have on Trump, right? I read last week that the Russians sort of infiltrated online judicial websites. So who knows what's there that they have there. But also, Trump is not going to stand up for the United States, despite all of his machinations. He's standing up for himself. I do think he wants to build something on a nice shore somewhere in Russia, and maybe it would be the expanded Russia. Sure. Maybe it's the Crimean Sea and blah, blah, blah. You know, he's not doing this for anybody but himself and his other autocrats. Let's be honest. He likes Putin, or he worships Putin. He worships the guy in Hungary. You know, he worships everybody who's an autocrat. He thinks that's the right way of doing things. That's the right way of running a country. We're seeing that being played out in D.C. right now with what they're doing, taking over law enforcement, which is a joke in itself. Not law enforcement, but the takeover. And, you know, I just think that if any of us expected that there was going to be a positive outcome now, having the other European leaders in the room today, I think will make a difference, because they'll say, sorry, no. You know, you're part of NATO. You're going to pull out of NATO? You know, we've already upped our game in NATO because you told us we had to 4 years ago. So we did, right? What's going to happen today? It'll be very interesting to watch, because what is he going to say? Oh, no, now we need to go back to the ceasefire after he said, I agree with Vlad. Let's go right to a deal, a ceasefire, a peace deal, and give up all the land.
It's funny, Rubio was so defensive about
the
European leaders coming mm-hmm. in with Zelensky. And it's like, look, the entire world saw how well that went in February.
Right.
Of course they're going to come in, because Trump is totally unhinged and needs to be, you know, wrangled. And, I mean, we can't have that happening again.
No, we can't.
And meanwhile, the State Department, how did we find out key information about this meeting? They left papers on the hotel printer.
You know, you can't make this up.
It's done. So I just want to read, just because I don't think we have enough joy in our life. I just want to read this paragraph. And I know it's not funny. Malia, you already have the furrow in your brow. I know this isn't, but it is, right? I mean, okay. So papers with the U.S. State Department markings found Friday morning in the business center of an Alaskan hotel revealed previously undisclosed and potentially sensitive details about the August 15th meeting. 8 pages that appear to have been produced by U.S. staff and left behind accidentally shared precise locations and meeting times of the summit and phone numbers of U.S. government employees. At around 9 p.m. on Friday, 3 guests at the Hotel Captain Cook, a 4-star hotel located 20 minutes from the Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage, where leaders from the U.S. and Russia convened, found the documents left behind in one of the hotel's public printers. NPR reviewed photos of the documents taken by one of the guests, who NPR agreed not to identify because the guest said they feared retaliation.
I'm just surprised they used the hotel printer. Don't you bring these things with you?
Most of the Kinkos have closed.
Right, and these are people who don't, I don't know, they just don't care about protocol or foreign policy or doing things the right way.
Do you think they emailed the documents to concierge?
I mean, the president travels with an extensive communications suite.
One would think.
That
has printers?
That has printers, yes. So I don't understand that. I think this afternoon's meeting is very dangerous for Zelensky, because the player of, again, going back to these 4 major players, Russia, Ukraine, United States, and Europe, the player that has the least at stake is the one who's going to determine the outcome, and that's the mm-hmm. United States. And what does Trump have to look forward to in today's meeting? Being wrangled or being told what to do by a bunch of Europeans that he doesn't like? Or the specter of Putin, who doesn't necessarily directly tell him what to do, just confidently says what he wants and is not budging from that. And so, like, I don't expect it to go very well. I'm not sure if all of these European leaders were originally planning to all be there in person, but let's go through the list. It's the Secretary General of NATO, the President of the European Commission, the French president, British prime minister, German chancellor, Italian prime minister, and the president of Finland. So that sort of underscores just how seriously they take this, because it affects them far more than it affects the United States. And so, like, they have some specific things that they want Donald Trump to do. I mean, imagine if you're the president of Finland right now. That's they've become much more active in NATO over the past couple years because of Trump's increasing closeness with Russia.
So let me ask a really naive, dumb question. Well, why are we running the show here? Like, what? I understand our great involvement in it.
Yeah.
I understand how important this is to the United States of America, as it is to these other allies and these other European nations who will be present at the White House this afternoon. But why is it two men in a room and one of them isn't Zelensky?
I think it was Madeleine Albright who called the United States the indispensable nation. And that's something that Trump is not going to want to give up, the idea that the United States is indispensable. And still, we're still the largest economy in the world. We still are providing a lot of arms to Ukraine. It's not nearly as much as it used to be, but there still are things that we're giving and facilitating. So it's important for Ukraine, from the Ukrainian point of view, from the European point of view, they don't want to lose that U.S. involvement. Because it still is, to a certain extent, supporting Ukraine security and European security.
Let's pause there. We have many letters. We'll get to those in just a moment as we discuss the meeting that took place on Friday and the meetings that will take place this afternoon in Washington, D.C. regarding the relationship between the United States, Ukraine, and Russia. We will continue. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. The broadcast continues after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our discussion this morning. We should mention that Russia pounded Ukraine overnight, and Volodymyr Zelensky has described the strikes as cynical attacks ahead of the key White House meeting that we have been discussing on the program. Let's go to letters now, and we have quite a few. Vicky says, how can there be any consideration for a Nobel Peace Prize considering the number of deaths which have already occurred during the USAID cuts, to say nothing of the potential deaths going forward? Should these cuts not be fully reinstated? Is peace not more than a lack of war?
Yeah, there's that really ugly irony, I find, that Trump, I think before he went up to Alaska, I just remember seeing him in front of a backdrop that said pursuing peace. And that's part of the theater of this, that now he's pursuing peace. He got rid of USAID, which that's a lot of what it's focused on is creating conditions for peace. But he's not interested in peace that doesn't come through deal making.
Russ asks this question in a message titled Inexplicable. Why is the United States government pressuring Ukraine to surrender? What's in it for the American citizen? It's an interesting question.
That's right. I think one of the ways we can tell that our country is becoming more autocratic is that Trump is increasingly conflating his personal interests with the interests of the nation. Is it in United States' interests to abandon Ukraine and allow European security to weaken? I would say no, but that's not how the current president of the United States sees it. I think Catherine was right when she identified, economic possibility. I think that continues to be an animating factor for the president. And there's more economic possibility in stability. I wouldn't call it peace, instability, than in war. That's not entirely true all the time, but for him, the kind of economic possibility that he's interested in.
He's far too short-sighted to understand how those economic possibilities could be undermined with Russia winning, right, this war. And throughout Europe, there have been hybrid attacks that have been connected to Russia. And these things could easily happen to us. And they know that there was Russian involvement in the election. But Trump sees it as, well, it's been working out for me just fine. So mm-hmm. What do I care? Right. And I worry that, a lot of Americans are adopting his personal interests and thinking, oh, well, these are my interests, too.
We go to Paul, who writes, at least 10 people have been slaughtered by Trump's best friend since Friday. All the blather from everyone means nothing. And the war? Simple. The Russia invaders slash war criminals must cease the bombing and remove their troops, thus stopping the death and destruction immediately. What fools these mortals be. Always good to end your note with a Shakespeare quote. I think that's good. Then we go to John, who says, if Trump is so submissive to Putin because Putin has the Epstein files, Europe should get them too and blackmail him back. He is so guilty, I believe. And yes, that's my personal opinion, says John, which is allowed when you write a letter to this program to have to present your personal opinion.
So I'll just point out that you can be an agent of a foreign power without even knowing it. You don't necessarily. There are people who are doing Russia's bidding around the world, some of whom are manipulated into it, tricked into it. Some of them sign up and know they're double agents, right? But whether or not the Epstein files are in Russia's hands or whatever is included in that, the plain fact of the matter is they came out of this meeting on Friday with Trump parroting Putin's and doing his bidding in effect. And mm-hmm. whether that's because Putin has something on him or Donald Trump knows that he's acting as an agent of Russia, it's the same outcome either way.
What do you think we read into the fact that the meeting was much shorter than it was expected to be? The meeting there was no press conference. There was a meeting of the two, but they didn't take questions from the press. Details were very slight, except for those that have emerged over the weekend and those that were found on a printer at a hotel in Alaska. But other than that, not a whole lot.
So it was only 2 hours long? Is that what they said? Yeah. So, I mean, in those kind of – I've never been in a meeting between heads of state, but in those kinds of meetings generally and because there's interpretation as well, so it's slow, right? So you spend the first 30 to 45 minutes doing pleasantries and making sure everyone knows who everyone is in the room. And then let's say Putin probably made it pretty clear right at the beginning of what he wasn't going to do. And then maybe Donald Trump tried to well, what about this? What about that? And it became clear. Putin, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to agree to that. These are my goals. And I imagine Donald Trump saw that there wasn't going to be any movement there.
Yeah, just folded. Actually, the schedule leaked, right? We can just see when it ended.
Yeah,
he doesn't know how to play hardball with the big boys. He can only play hardball with people who are less than him. Like his contractors and all those people who he's built over the years.
The other aspect of this, which we haven't discussed yet on this program, and I don't know how important it is in the great scheme of things, but there was what they seemed to agree on is that there was Russian interference mm-hmm. in the 2016 mm-hmm. election. And that Trump did indeed win the election in 2020. And that seemed to be, and for Trump, that was a great victory in that there was that admission that came out, those two things, which I thought we had settled, but I guess not. And there we are.
The other thing we can't take for granted here is the radical Christian right, white supremacist nationalists' support of a regime like Russia, because Putin also allows the more conservative religious folks in Russia to play a role. And our folks are talking into, people like the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, and the Heritage Foundation and the Project 2025 people are like, this is what the conservative Christians would like too, because, A, Zelensky's a Jew, but B, how about just letting Russia take over and then we don't have to deal with this anymore? And Vlad's our guy because he likes the conservative Christian elements in his country, too. There's always that.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll move on to other topics. Two quick letters, actually, that came in that I'll get to since we have about 30 seconds. Jim says, Putin looked like a real leader. Trump was Trump. Putin won the day, especially at home. This was a bad day for America, but worse for Ukraine. And then there, we'll end with this letter from Dave, who says, at Putin's suggestion, a mat and Trump was again given his marching orders. Has anyone seen anything more disgusting than Donald Trump sycophancy and garish subservience to a mass murdering war criminal than what we've seen over and over again? We'll pause there. We'll be back in just a few moments to continue the program. First, we have news with Ray Graff. Well, good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning, Malia Dumont is with us, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College. And political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post joins us, as does Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College, Catherine Tan. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we always enjoy having you with us on this program. Let's talk about, it seems like we have had this discussion over the last week, week and a half, but we'll continue it this morning, where we look at redistricting and what was going on initially in Texas, and then we heard murmurings from other states, including the state of California. Many state delegations are already under single-party control. New maps could tighten the partisan grip while decreasing the importance of general elections. President Trump's drive to secure Republican advantage in the House through mid-decade redistricting and Democrats' move to retaliate with their own efforts to redraw political lines to their advantage could supercharge the partisan shift in Congress. Should the efforts succeed, they would amplify the trend of one party gaining a stranglehold on state congressional delegations, intensifying the deep polarization that has helped to paralyze Congress in recent years. Also, it is important to, I think, to point out that the president announced this morning, just about 28 minutes ago, on Truth Social, that he will lead a movement to eliminate mail-in ballots. So I think we can lump these stories together because of what they are as when it comes to voter suppression?
Yeah, voter suppression. That's what it's called.
President Trump said on Monday that he would lead a movement to eliminate mail-in ballots and would sign an executive order to help bring honesty, shoddy caps, to the 2026 midterm elections. Mr. Trump has long opposed mail-in voting and said it was a source of fraud during the 2020 presidential election, though his attorney general at the time said that his assertions of widespread fraud could not be proven. And just for the hell of it, just for whatever it's worth, I will say that I think it is important to remember that that same system, a slightly different system, but one that was supposed to actually curtail more, was used in 2024, in which the president won. And with that, I have nothing more to say. Libby.
The man doesn't want open elections. He wants to be a dictator. He's a fascist. This is what fascists do. First, they take over local policing and put their big trucks and, you know, Humvees in the streets. They have masked people coming and taking people off the street without any due process. And now we don't need the elections. And that's really what he wants, is to not have any elections at all. But what he is doing, first of all, and Malia will talk about this, it will disenfranchise a lot of people. A lot of people will no longer be able to vote, which is something I think he's okay with, right? And then going after the voting machines, what does he want to do? Go back to the days of Don Segretti, that was his name, right? In from Watergate, where they used to stuff ballot boxes. It was a much more colorful term that they used, but I can't use it on the air. But, you know, it'll be paper ballots that you check off, fold up, put into a ballot box, and then vote. Are we going to all stick our finger in ink like they do in some countries to show that you voted? I mean, we are, or have been, seen as the bellwether of how to do elections. Our people go places to show other countries how to do elections, or at least we did, right? It's part of USAID. It was part of just democracy building around the world. And now he's giving voice to, oh, let's get rid of the franchise for so many people. And hopefully, and then on top of that, let's rig the elections in 2026 to guarantee that Republicans will stay in control of the House by redistricting. Mm-hmm. It's what he's doing, as far as I'm concerned, is criminal. However, this Supreme Court is not going to push back on him. They've already weakened the Voting Rights Act.
It's criminal. But I also think that this is a bringing back anything relating to voting is an effort to bring to pander to his base. Mm-hmm. He knows that he has lost some people because of the Epstein files. Right. And now this is a low hanging fruit that he can grasp and say, oh, yeah, don't forget. Remember how we take issues with elections and it's fraud and it's full of corruption. Well, here's another way to bring back a popular issue. Right. This is a way for him to bring back something that his voter base really enjoys talking about and reminding them, hey, I'm tough on crime. I'm tough on, you know, making sure elections are fair and votes are counted. This is something that he knows he can rely on and won't get in trouble with his base if he's, you know, showing that he's doing something about it or putting in an effort to correct some imaginary wrong.
Oh, yeah.
So I've taken advantage, used my right to vote by mail-in ballot once before. And it was in 2006 when I was in Kabul, Afghanistan, on behalf of the U.S. government, which sent me there to fulfill U.S. goals and missions in Afghanistan. So just a quick review of how many military personnel would be affected by this. We have over 30,000 troops who are permanently stationed in Korea. We have over 50,000 troops permanently stationed in Japan. Over 35,000 troops permanently stationed in Germany. Thousands more, Italy, Belgium, Netherlands, all, you know, countries around the world. Plus over 35,000 U.S. civilian government employees working in embassies. I mean, these are just small numbers, right? But we're just talking about people who have signed up to help advance U.S. interests around the world. Now, when you sign up for the military, you know that you're going to be giving up some of your rights. You do that voluntarily. You know, my freedom of speech is somewhat curtailed in certain circumstances because I am a member of the United States Army Reserve, and I understood that, and I willingly did that. I did not agree to give up my right to vote when sent overseas on U.S. missions, and I'm pretty sure that most of my fellow service members would be really upset to give up their right to vote. That's just too much to ask of people who volunteer to put themselves in harm's way, make lots of sacrifices, to sacrifice the most basic right you have in a democracy is not right. It's not right.
God, that is quite a headline, huh? Trump tries to disenfranchise the troops.
Well, what he'll say is, just nationally, just within our borders, just for the people who actually live here. Yeah. Well, those other people, they can use paper ballots.
That's what I'm interested in. Of as far as when it comes to our military voting, via mail, is that using the same mechanism that anyone else would, or is there a different process that perhaps could be maintained while the other goes away?
It all depends on what your home of record is. So when I was in Afghanistan, my official home of record, and the home that I went back to after my service there was over, was Alexandria, Virginia. When I wasn't overseas with the military, I volunteered as a poll worker in the city of Alexandria. And shout out to them. Their election commissioner and office has always done, in my experience there, I lived there for many years, a tremendous job organizing and running elections. And so when I emailed them and I got a response the next day and with very clear instructions. And so I was able to fill out my ballot and I had one of my fellow service members witness it and sign it. And then there were instructions for how to mail it in. And that was all through the election commissioner of the city where mm-hmm. I lived, and that's how it works for troops.
Right, here in Albany, and you know, it's all county-based election boards of elections, and they send out absentee ballots to everyone who asks, including the military. Those ballots go out a little earlier, you know. But let's not forget Article 1, Paragraph 4, Clause 1 provides. It's the Elections Clause of the Federal Constitution, and it says the states control the elections, period, end of story. So he'd have to, if he wants to do this, he needs to have a constitutional amendment where two-thirds of the states say, yes, we're going to give up our rights to control the elections. And I think that even the Republicans, look at, you know, the guys down in Georgia in 2020, they stood firm, the Secretary of State. I don't think it's going to happen, but it's just another talking point and another object over there, so you don't look mm-hmm. at Jeffrey Epstein on the other side of the room. All of this is about that.
But right, but I'm concerned about the willingness of Republican-led states, whether they're Republican governors, Republican-led state legislatures, who appear very eager to fall in line with Trump by doing things like, this is another one of the stories that maybe we're going to discuss a little bit more in detail later today, is by sending troops that are not needed to Washington, mm-hmm. D.C.
Right.
And so will some of them say, oh, yes, we're very concerned about fraud in elections. And so we're going to, you know, we're in charge of elections, so we're going to do what's needed in our state. And then they'll basically, you know, he's just pulling their strings. He doesn't need to officially try to take over or have an amendment passed if Republicans and state legislatures will do his bidding.
Yeah, and sure. And these are states where they perceive that their party would benefit mm-hmm. from voter suppression, right? And that's precisely what this is. It's an attempt to disenfranchise as many unwanted voters or undesirable voters as possible.
Well, yeah, just to clarify on that. So I'm sure from the Trump administration perspective, they don't view a lot of military vote, like that's not the undesirable mm-hmm. voter. But so I shared these numbers just a few moments ago. But those numbers of mail-in ballots are dwarfed by the other populations that use mail-in ballots. And so who are those people who would be really disenfranchised? It's a lot of the working poor who can't take the day off to go on a Tuesday in November to the polls.
A lot of people can't take the day off.
Right.
Right.
Just, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's not a federal holiday.
So let's just focus in on that for a second. Libby, this is your business. So who are did that make it sound crass? No.
What?
When I said it, that's your business.
No, it's fine.
Yeah. I mean, it's what you do, right?
It is.
You work elections and campaigns.
Right. I run campaigns. And
so,
do that stuff.
But my question is for you, how important is mail in voting? And is it possible to, given any given area, of who a mail in voter is and what you lose by what the president wrote on Truth Social this morning?
So it's called absentee ballot voting.
Okay.
That's what the mail-in ballots are, at least here in New York. If a race is close, it'll come down to absentee ballots. In the 6th ward of the city of Albany, that race was incredibly close, and And the woman who won, Deirdre Brody, won, I think, by 2 or 3 votes, and it was after the absentees were counted. It has to do with what the, I mean, they all get counted, but whether or not they have an impact has to do with how close the race is off of the machines. And for anybody who's in the lead, the opponent has to pick up 2 absentee ballots to every one that the person in the lead has to picks up in order to balance things out a little bit. Sometimes it's very, very, very close and these work. Sometimes the absentee ballots, and maybe Trump doesn't realize this, reflect or go along the same voting patterns as the regular ballots did, as the in-person voting did. I have found that with library votes, there's never really a big dichotomy of absentees when I was doing those kinds of votes. And, you know, in Albany, it's always a primary. So, and that's one of the things that came out of, you know, the other story about voting is if we end up in a country with redistricting where only the primary matters, the vast majority of people will not have a say in who is their elected official. Mm. In Albany, it's a 40-1 Democratic enrollment edge in the city. And so it's always the primary. And, you know, there's always some Republican who's going to run for mayor, and they never win. But the absentee ballots can be very, very important if it's a close race. And the other part of this is that people have been voting absentee forever, and there's never been a real problem. And he's making this all up. Really, he's making this all up. And yes, some of his Republican governors may capitulate, you know, but the Constitution is pretty clear. And if it went to the Supreme Court, it would be really difficult for them to say, oh no, because they've already upheld certain things in the Constitution around voting. So
just say that there are vulnerabilities to any process, mm-hmm. whether it's run by a government or a business or whatever. And so there are unique vulnerabilities to mail-in ballots, as was demonstrated when there was a man in Oregon during the previous election who like firebombed some of the ballot boxes where people.
Right.
And so that obviously that only happens with mail-in ballots. Right. But there are things you can do to identify and mitigate against those kinds of unique vulnerabilities. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about,
fireproof.
How to empower and enable as many voters as possible, because that's the American way.
Anybody else? All right. Let me see. I want to go to letters on this, and then we'll move on to other topics that we have in the news. We welcome your letters at panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. A ban on mail-in voting will hurt the handicapped. I have a handicapped friend who always votes by mail. It would be very difficult to vote in person. Another. Mm-hmm.
My dad was in hospice for the past mm-hmm. 2 years of his, the final 2 years of his life, and there was no way that he could have made it to an actual polling place.
Didn't Putin comment on American elections and ballots during his press briefing in Anchorage? Yes. Right?
What?
The question is, didn't Putin comment on American elections and ballots during his press briefing, quote unquote, in Anchorage? And that was in regards to the fact that it was that Trump had won the election.
That there wasn't
in 2020.
Yeah, there wasn't any interference then.
And or in 2016. Thank you, Libby and Malia. This is autocracy, and it's frightening. I'm glad you're calling it out. Controlling elections and disenfranchising voters while declaring themselves the protectors of freedom and fair elections is what fascists do. We were unhappy with the panel the other day when they were hardly alarmed that Trump wants to take over all of the Smithsonian museums including the Hirshhorn Art Museum. Controlling museums leads to changing history and is as autocratic as you can get. Interfering with art museums is exactly what Hitler did. This is very, very scary. Please tell your panelists last week what it means when the government steps into every area of life and interfering with museums is an indication of the arrival of autocracy. I will admit I was off that day, but we'll call those panelists into the principal's office. I doubt it very much that the panelists were all for the changing of history when it comes to museums, but I would have to listen back to the program and see, or simply ask Sarah, who hosted, what indeed they said. Let's see. First of all, there is mail-in voting in Russia and at least 30 other countries. So Putin lied and he believed him. So what else is new? That is from Janice in a message called Lying Liars Together. Then we go to...
yes, there's mail-in voting in Russia, but the options of who to vote for are a little slim.
We go back to Evangeline. Please be careful with your words. Not all Christians who are conservative support or have supported Trump and what he represents, let alone support a monster like Putin and what he is doing to an innocent population. Broad assumptions like this are tearing our neighborhoods further apart. With respect, Ellen from Poughkeepsie. Thank you. Also, we go to Jack, who says, Trump was played like a fiddle in Alaska by Putin. His extreme deferential treatment and failure to develop anything substantive lends more and more credence to the assertions that Trump has been a Soviet asset since the mid-1980s. Craig Unger's books thoroughly support this idea and ask for Craig to be on the book show, and we'll certainly see what we can do. Let's see. I think we have time for one more letter. Walter says, one of your correspondents asked whether we have ever seen such subservience towards a mass murderer, Putin. Yes, we have. Biden and Trump towards Netanyahu.
What?
All right. I just needed one word as a response from the panel, and that word was what? So that's I'll take that as an answer because it was the first thing that went into my mind as well. Trump's attacks on mail-in voting gives us another way to attack the results he doesn't like and to attempt to nullify the results or call them into question. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll finish up the panel. We have other topics to discuss, and we will do just that on this Monday morning, the 18th of August. We'll continue after messages and news. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have Malia Dumont, Libby Post, and Catherine Tan with us, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you as always. Let's go to new topics as we continue our look into what has been happening and what is happening in the world. We go to D.C. We go to Washington, D.C. And this is, stop me if you've heard this, but there are mixed signals from the Trump administration over what they want to do in D.C. and what these mixed signals mean for the District of Columbia. The White House and D.C. leadership have each tried to assert that they are in control of the force, even as they emphasize cooperation and shared priorities. National Guard troops have begun deploying on the streets of D.C. with Humvees and troops spotted along the National Mall a day after President Trump federalized the local police department. and issued officers a far-reaching mandate to do whatever the hell they want to curb crime. Yet it remained unclear what new directives, if any, D.C. police would receive from their new federal managers. District officials said they were still in command of the department operating as usual, having received no new orders from the Trump administration. The city's police chief, Pamela Smith, has been supplying ideas about how federal law enforcement could be used by D.C., not the other way around, according to a D.C. official who spoke on the condition of anonymity. Continuing, the White House, however, says the project continued to project clear control of this. We plan to work with the D.C. police. The White House press secretary said this last week, but ultimately the chain of command is as such. The President of the United States, the Attorney General of the United States, our DEA Administrator Terry Cole, who she said is in charge of the department and is working with the chief to ensure that law enforcement officers are allowed to do their jobs in the city. So we look at this as it continues, and there has been some court action on this as well, and we watch that as it unfolds. I believe that over the weekend we saw the National Guard troops nearly double with new deployment orders that were made on Saturday. We had a discussion on this program on Friday. We had a panelist who was correct, but kept on saying that those National Guard troops were not armed. They have now announced that many of those troops will be able to carry firearms and will be armed with in the city. And so the way to sum this up, before I hand it over to our very able colleagues, that this crisis, quote unquote, enters its second week with more soldiers and no exit strategy. Draw your conclusions as to or your thoughts as to how that mirrors other situations in our world. But Malia.
So I have a couple different interests in this story. One is as a member of the military myself, but also my brother and his wife and three kids adopted from South Korea, one of whom is trans, live on Capitol Hill right in the middle of Washington, D.C. And so as a family, we're very concerned about what the immediate future holds for them, how they will be treated as they attempt to go about their lives in a normal way. Just to refresh or share with the listeners a little bit about what enables this to happen. So it's in order to enable state-level officials to respond quickly to emergencies, there's something called National Guard Mutual Assistance Compacts. And you have to have these in place ahead of time so that when an emergency happens, you can flow troops in quickly. And so that's what allowed a lot of National Guard troops to show up in New Orleans fairly quickly after Katrina, for example, or if there's an earthquake somewhere. I mean, so a lot of these scenarios are exercised and tested at the federal level all the time, and relying on states near and far to help whatever state is in the most trouble for whatever emergency occurs. So that is a normal process, and that's a normal thing that happens. Now, I'm not aware of a purely so-called law enforcement mission being used to invoke one of these compacts before. And about 25% of the landmass in D.C. is federal. So these troops, theoretically, I guess legally, aren't required to coordinate with the D.C. police. I mean, the D.C. police, in a sense, can be bypassed. I mean, Trump wanted to take over the D.C. police. That isn't available to him, or it's too hard. But he can go this other way to increase federal troop presence. Now, National Guard troops are not automatically federal. They exist in two different statuses. They can be federalized. And I don't know if they have been yet in this case. That's a legal issue. But even if they're not federalized, their commanders in chief, when they're not federalized, are their governors. And the governors are following what they think Trump wants them to do. Just as an aside, as I've seen from some of the pictures I've seen of the troops who are already in our nation's capital, enlisted National Guard troops, which probably makes up the majority of those who have been sent, the enlisted folks, there's a significant percentage of them that are black, brown, you know, mm-hmm. all kinds of ethnic heritages, probably more than our president expects. And so this means the face of the law enforcement mm-hmm. that he is bringing to D.C. is it's a lot of black and brown people in uniform. FYI, Mr. President.
Well, he'd probably be okay with the fact that people of color in uniform are going to be beating up people of color on the street, right? It's not us. It's those people shouldn't be here. And so these other people we brought in are going to take care of it for us. I think ultimately he's looking for a military parade in the street. Just, you know, like Putin has or his buddy in North Korea has. You know, that's what he'd really like. And, you know, the governor of Maryland took to social media this weekend with a video saying, I control the Maryland National Guard. You don't. The governor here, Kathy Hochul, basically said the same. You know, first he wants to take over elections, which are state responsibilities. Now the National Guard. God forbid there's some real tragedy that happens. You know, hurricane season is upon us, right? This hurricane that's in the Caribbean doesn't seem to be hitting us, I guess. But there are going to be other kinds of natural disasters where the National Guard is called out to help. And what are we going to do? Have everybody in D.C. and they're not going to be able to leave? I mean, it's really, he just wants an autocratic government where the military just totally says whatever he says to does whatever he says to do.
So much for limiting government, right? And keeping things small government.
Yeah, it's not small government. They don't want small government. They want their version of government.
Yeah. It's they'll them, call it the small. Big government.
Yeah, they'll call it small, but it's really gigantic. Because look at the deficit. It's bigger than it's ever been.
And you know, if he wants to be so tough on crime, like he is a felon. Can we start there?
Right.
Right. And already they've arrested like 300 people, 135 undocumented immigrants. They cleared out 44 homeless encampments. I mean, we have to step back and think about what does Trump mean when he is talking about crime? He's a felon, right? Mm-hmm. And he's out there not offering like social services to vulnerable populations, but you know, dismantling people's places where they live, disrupting lives. And you know, a lot of the people who are picked up in these ICE raids right now, we know are not the the hard criminals that he said he was going to go after. These are people who are working hard, trying to provide for their families. But aside from all that, like you said, this is a spread of authoritarianism, right? People are, he is trying to show his base that he is a tough guy, right? A tough president. And this is, you know, if you're not living in D.C. or in one of these cities that these Democrat-led cities that he's attacking, you know, people have no idea what things are like on the ground. All they have to go off of is what the media is portraying and what Trump is claiming, that these are horribly dangerous places. And crime has been going down in D.C., right? And so this is a misrepresentation of what is happening. Now, you know, crime rates could always be lower. There's always more work to be done in order to create a safe city. But bringing in a bunch of officers is not the way to go. He claims that this is going to help people feel safer in the streets. Mm-mm. But which people? Who's going to feel safer in the streets with all of these officers now armed, right? And in our country, in you know, especially in this last decade, we know that there are plenty of cases in which innocent people are hurt or killed by the police, right? Just having them armed out in the street, you have to be a bit worried about their biases, right? Who are they going to target? Who's going to be vulnerable? Like, who are they protecting when they are out there and told they can do whatever they want and they can identify crime as it appears to them?
We are out of time. My thanks to this amazing group, and thank you so much for your insights and your time this morning. It is much appreciated. Libby, Catherine, Malia, thank you so much. Be well and have a great day. We will continue our conversation next on the Roundtable. Well, I think we're still on. It's all right. It's okay. We're doing double duty. So there's we're getting a guest on the phone, and
oh, here comes Sarah.
We don't have a guest.
No, we don't have a guest. So I guess we're going to 11.
No, I thought we had a guest.
Well, I can speak generally then. A point I was going to make on this previous story: the rules of engagement. So when in the military you are carrying a weapon, which you don't always do, right? I mean, I did all the time when I was in Afghanistan, but I never have in other circumstances. You get very clear rules of engagement, and they are specific to the mission and to the role that you are playing. So I don't know what the rules of engagement are for this particular mission. So saying that you're armed doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have ammunition. Hmm. So these troops, one possibility is they're carrying weapons, but there's no ammunition, so it's meant to be intimidating somehow. Or they could have ammunition, but it's not loaded. Like, you carry ammunition in your ammunition pouch, and you don't expect to have any emergencies where you have to, like, be firing immediately, and that is one way to try to minimize accidents or, civilian casualties.
Right.
Or you could be told you got to be armed and loaded at all times, which means you have ammunition ready to, like, in the weapon, and you're ready to fire. Those are the kind of things that the commanders of these troops are going to be instructing the soldiers on.
But it also sounds like they are emboldened to, even without weapons, emboldened to do whatever.
Yeah, do whatever they want without due process.
So coming up on tomorrow's show, we'll talk about the fact that Democratic lawmakers in Texas mm-hmm. have ended their walkout. We'll also talk about one of the oddest stories I've heard in quite a while. MSNBC is changing their name to MS Now. You ask, what is that short for? MS used to be Microsoft. Yeah.
Right.
And Now stands for My Source News Opinion World.
Weird.
That makes no
dumb.
Sense.
It sounds like a new beauty pageant. Yeah. Miss Now.
It sounds like they had now, right. like they had dice with words on it, and they just took them out. So it's My Source News Opinion. No, My Source News Opinion World, as part of a corporate a spinoff from Comcast. So
can I share a plug for an upcoming event that I think might be of interest to some readers? So the word joy, believe it or not, was brought up at least once during this conversation today, and that is going to be the theme of the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and the Humanities at Bard College's conference this year, which is taking place October 16th and 17th. There will be an online streaming as well for those people who can't be there in person, but it's joy, loving the world in dark times. And so it should be, I think it's even timelier than we expected to be when the theme was first introduced. And we invite people to register. It's on the Hannah Arendt Center website. She's buried at Bard. She has a long affiliation with Bard, and is just her reading, her writing is really worth revisiting. And if you're interested in that as well, the Hannah Arendt Center has an online virtual reading group that folks are welcome to sign up for.
Great stuff. Malia Dumont, Catherine Tan, and Libby Post. Thank you very much. You are now free to go. Okay. You are now free to go. We'll be back right after this.
Support for WMC comes from Northshire Bookstore, an independent family-owned bookstore with locations in Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. Offering books, gifts, vinyl records, and more, northshire.com to shop online. And Thomas Cole National Historic Site, Catskill, celebrating Cole 200, the trip that changed American art. And the exhibition, Emily Cole, Ceramics, Flora, and Contemporary Responses, through November 2nd, info at thomascole.org.
This is Northeast Public Radio, WAMC FM HD 90.3 Albany, WRUN HD 90.3 Remsen Utica, WAMK HD 90.9 Kingston, WOSR HD 91.7 Middletown, WCEL HD 91.9 Plattsburgh, WCAN HD 93.3 Canajoharie, WANC HD 103.9 Ticonderoga, WAMQ HD 105.1 Great Barrington, WWES HD 88.9 Mount Kisco, WANC HD 90.1 Stamford, WANR 88.5 Brewster, WQQQ 103.3 Sharon, and WAMCA.